This is a production of Cornell University.
Giving this presentation, similar, I presented this information to the Faculty Senate, to the UA. I will present it to the SA, and I'm sure there's others, but I can't remember them. This presentation is really for the information of the GPSA, mainly. It focuses, as you'll see, mostly on some plans around undergraduate student housing, but I want to put this in context of the overall efforts that we're undertaking. So, big picture, what I'd like to talk about the three major goals that Beth and I talked about when she asked me to accept a job as provost, and the goals that Hunter has embraced and that I've talked about with our new incoming president are, first of all, the student experience. That relates to an initiative around the undergraduate curriculum. Also, student housing, as you'll see, this is also graduate housing and includes Maplewood and some efforts in Collegetown that I'll speak about peripherally. And then our efforts in diversity advising and living learning, where we have a number of efforts ongoing. Second major goal is to connect the campus, that is connecting the campuses across Ithaca on this campus, connecting faculty, connecting students, a number of initiatives in that area, and also enhancing collaborations to our other campuses, both at Law Cornell and Cornell Tech. And then finally, investment in academics, and this relates a little bit to some financial pressure that's put on our academic units for some period of time. I like to talk about this as deferred academic investment. We had a period where major investment, particularly in financial aid, stressed the budget of Cornell colleges for a period of time. We're now coming out of that, and Beth and I really focused on trying to invest in faculty and our academic programs. These multidisciplinary initiatives are part of that, as they are part of connecting Cornell, provides a sense of momentum and recruitment advantages. And it balances those things that we do from the center, from the provost office, in terms Cornell Tech with the Ithaca campus, and academic unification in general, trying to connect the medical school, our Cornell Tech campus, and Ithaca. So I like to talk about these in terms of deferred academic investment, constrained academic budgets, and lack of central flexibility, and deferred capital investment. Those are for programmatic investments that we need in our new programs, biomedical engineering, computer and information sciences, which is growing rapidly and needs space. Academic buildings that require investment, broad, currently held together by pipes connecting one facade to another facade. Our existing student housing, as you'll hear, we have student housing that has significant deferred maintenance. And then we don't have capacity for one of Cornell's principal goals, which is to provide on-campus housing for all of our freshmen and sophomore undergraduate students. So the key here for me is to be able to solve both of these in a balanced way, to not solve this problem at the expense of this problem or this problem at the expense of this problem. And I'll talk a little bit more about how we plan to do that. So for student housing, just to give you a sense of the scope of the problem on the undergraduate side, we have, as I said, deferred maintenance. We can't fix that deferred maintenance currently because we have every bed occupied. So to fix, for example, Bulge, the deferred maintenance in Bulge, we have to empty it out and renovate it, and that would take about a year. We have no place to put those students, so if we did that, we'd lose 450 beds about for sophomores currently, and we don't have enough space for sophomores. So we need swing space, the sophomore demand I'll show you, and then as we talk about addressing this problem, it will require more dining on campus. And at the same time, we're having discussions with others in College Town who are driving significant change in College Town. Currently, you see a lot of the building that's going on. There'll be more in the future. We're trying to influence that in a way to create the best kind of final solution for our student body. Undergraduates, where we're thinking about first and second year on campus, third and fourth off campus, but also more graduate possibilities and at different price points, so it's not all at the high-end price point. So I'll talk about framing the solution, the options that we have in the next steps here, and here's, again, a little bit the problem. You see that our deferred maintenance, our sophomore capacity, currently we house about 60% of our sophomores, and we have every bed taken. So this is between fraternity sororities, program housing, and our on-campus housing. We need about 1,400 more beds if we can extend the promise that we provide to our sophomores that we want you to live on campus. And then we have juniors and seniors mostly living off campus, but that's a little bit more of a separation that occurs naturally as students begin to mature, undergraduate students begin to mature on campus. So as Ryan has talked about, Vice President Lombardi has talked about, Student Campus Life has commissioned an external report, a master plan for student housing. That basically comes up with this paradigm of on-campus first 2 years, off-campus largely the second 2 years, with some ability for students who want to live in West Campus and for whom there's room or want to live on North Campus to be able to do that in program houses, et cetera. So that plan comes up with new housing. You see a freshman village here with some new housing here, a sophomore village with new housing here, and then probably a new dining facility here would solve this problem. It allows us to have the capacity on North Campus. There are a number of sophomores currently living, engineers living on North Campus, so it's not as though North Campus is exclusively freshmen. The idea would be to build a community that is freshmen and sophomores on North Campus, and eventually positions 7-8 years, and that is, we go back to FY08 before the financial aid initiative of David Scorton, of one of two, we were investing about $80 million a year from our operating budget in financial aid. We're now spending almost $200 million annually on financial aid. So roughly $120 million more expended from our operating budget. That got us into the league, if you will, of the other IDs in terms of financial aid. That is, we're still the least generous in financial aid, but we're very close to our IG peers now. It was a courageous commitment, but one that really stressed our operating budget because, unlike the other IDs, we have a larger undergraduate cohort, and we have less endowment to fund. So we fund far more, roughly 80% of this, out of our operating budget. That has created the financial stress that we're just coming out of. And you see here that Cornell is about 85-86% from our unrestricted grant, and the next highest is 73, and you see Harvard, Princeton, Yale funding essentially mostly out of their debt. So what we've determined is that no combination of tuition, reasonable tuition hikes, reasonable extension of our financial aid policy, controlling costs will allow us on our operating budget to solve both problems. We can make investments in academics, but we will not have the capital to build up to be able to solve this problem in a reasonable time frame. And we will not have the capital to be able to invest in major renovations like McGraw or Bulge, for example. So we need a responsible and creative solution. And framing that solution, what we've said is that we're not going to, as I said, sacrifice one type of investment for another. We're not going to do our capital at the cost of academics. We're not going to predicate these building projects on fundraising, because that's been an issue that we've had in the past, where we said we fundraise to build physical sciences or West Campus before that, and in fact we end up paying it off as debt without a revenue source dedicated to paying it off. So we essentially create an unintended consequence stressing academic budgets. So we want a solid revenue plan for any commitment that we make in this plan that allows us to address these problems. So our general plan is to build residence halls to provide swing space for swing space, more sophomore capacity, and more undergrads. And part of this plan is a modest increase in enrollment for our undergraduate class, and I'll talk about why and how. So the modest enrollment will enable construction financing without constraining in our academic investment. We'll provide revenue sources in areas to be able to pay off debt to do this undergraduate housing. Student growth will come with more faculty and more staff, so we're not doing this simply on the backs of existing faculty and staff. And then the growth in the student body will also generate funds for academic investments. The first call will be to pay off our loans, our debt. This revenue source will generate funds in colleges that benefit from these student building projects. But it will also generate some academic investment funds. So the details of this are still emerging a little bit, but I want to give everyone in the campus some notice of this and some ability to comment. We've got a lot of comments on this. And so the first thing is we are proposing to increase freshmen something between 250 and 275 new students. Now I want to put this in context because we have launched a number of new programs, or programs have grown, that have been asking for biomedical engineering, new major, with no new students for engineering. And so engineering is essentially robbing other majors to be able to launch its biomedical engineering program. It's hired faculty already, but it does not have new students. And when I became provost, one of the things that I inherited was the problem the previous provost had, which was virtually every dean was saying to the provost, I want more students. And the reality is we're in a zero-sum game because we have a commitment that we will not accept more students than we can house on North Campus as freshmen. So that has led to deans saying to the provost, I don't care where you get them, but give me more students. I need more students. So there are four major areas where academically we have a very strong need for more students. I mentioned engineering. Arts and sciences is the second area where right now we have a historic faculty to student ratio that's the highest it's been in 20 years. And arts and sciences is the lowest percentage of this campus that it's been in decades. The reason for that is they did not increase while other colleges increased their transfer student intake. And secondly, arts and sciences, as has occurred nationally, everywhere, many of the students are taking more and more courses in computer and information sciences or in business. And so a smaller proportion of they're teaching a smaller proportion of courses to their own students, which is the way it should be, but they need to grow. The third is Cal, which has needs to be backfilled from the students whose revenue they lost as part of the creation of the College of Business. And the fourth is the College of Business, which has had historic high demand in Dyson and a great desire on the part of the hotel to increase their intake as well. So our plan is to initiate a capital project on North Campus for something between 1,250 beds and 2,050 beds. Our trustees are now urging us to solve this problem all at once. 1,250 beds would handle about half of the sophomore demand. 1,950 would handle all the sophomore demand. And the trustees are saying, build something, think about 2,050 to give you some flexible room there. The idea would be to complete these by the fall of 2020. So very ambitious, very aggressive. And at the same time, the first thing we'll do is build space that we can renovate Balch in. When Balch is renovated the next year, we'll take more sophomores into that space. And then partners with others to build more capabilities in College Town for our juniors and seniors that are hopefully lower cost and higher quality. Don't have the safety problems that I'm sure many of you have experienced in College Town. So I've gone through why increase the freshman class. It provides funds for academic investment. It addresses shifts in college enrollments that I've described. It accommodates new programs and solves a major student life problem on campus. Right now, if you're an undergrad, you come to Cornell as a freshman, almost immediately you're faced with signing a lease in College Town because otherwise you might not get a place in College Town in your sophomore year. So undergraduate enrollment growth, as I've said, every college has asked for more space, and I've gone through the major needs here, and these will be the major places where new students would be focused. Okay, so what are the downsides to this plan? I haven't told you yet about how we fund it, but there is a downside, which is a potential drop in our U.S. News and World Report ranking. U.S. News and World Report is a ranking that privileges really resources per student. So almost 15% or a significant percentage, do I have that here? Yeah, here it is. So 19% of this is the combination of expenditures per student, the total class size, and student to faculty ratio. So this part here, just this part here, is something that has disadvantaged Cornell already. Places with small students body and large endowments do very well in U.S. News and World Report. It's not playing to Cornell's strength or what Cornell is. So we may well drop. There are some ways we plan to mitigate this impact on U.S. News and World Report. I do think it's something that we need to pay attention to and not to just dismiss. But if it gets in the way of us solving a major problem on Cornell, such as the undergraduate experience, so be it. So class sizes, experience, and gateway courses, many of you are short TA in large courses, and we do have this concern around our gateway courses, and it's one of this increase in enrollment is the carrot that I plan to use over the next 2 years to really focus on managing our gateway courses and solving what is an existing problem, whereas many students cannot get into gateway courses or initially are squeezed out of them and then maybe get in later. Or, for example, in CIS, many students cannot take CIS courses. If you're non-major, you can't get into a CIS gateway course. So we have to address these problems. It's multifactorial. It relates to our TAs. It relates to our ability to organize our class rooms so that the largest classrooms are focused on those areas that need them. And it relates to our ability to manage our scheduling so that we're not bunching all of our courses, large courses, between Tuesday and Thursday, 11 o'clock and noon. We have to do a better job of spreading this out and using the entire calendar. So that's something we have to work on anyway. So I do want to emphasize that we've had a lot of discussions about this over the last year. We started out with leadership discussions on deferred maintenance and housing, discussions with UFC, the University Faculty Committee, and the Financial Policy Committee. As I said, Vice President Lombardi engaged U3 Consulting to develop a plan here. We have this plan, and we've had a lot of back and forth leadership about it. Then in the spring of this past spring, we talked with the Board of Trustees about this, and their urge was to try and address this problem, try and think about what we could do to address it. We then, in the summer, had again leadership discussions with Interim President Hunter Rawlings. We had this preliminary master plan report. The provost, the vice provost, the vice presidents have all weighed in on this and agreed on an overall plan to address this. And then this fall, we've had discussions with the Board of Trustees, the Executive Committee, and as I've said, again, with UFC, joint meetings of our Finance and Executive Committees. We had a 2.5-hour discussion with those committees, and then just 2 weeks ago, we had a 4-hour meeting with the Board of Trustees run group to try and address how we do this through debt, we do it with public-private partnerships, what's the mechanism by which we achieve this. And then most recently, presentations to the deans. I should add that all the deans have signed off on this plan, to the Academic Affairs and Student Life, to the full board, Faculty Senate, SA, UA, now GPSA, and we'll go to the Employee Assembly. So we're trying to socialize this as much as possible, get everybody's input, get everybody engaged on this. Overall, the financial aspects of this are for the academic plan through a 5-year financial plan to achieve academic program investment and allow the revenues in the colleges to grow so they can invest in their own program efforts. And we're meeting beginning this week with the colleges laying out a 5-year financial plan where each of the colleges understands what they can expect from the center, and then that's sort of their baseline. We will not reduce subvention to or investment in individual colleges if they do better than planned, so they don't suffer from success. And then on the capital side, we will invest in repairing academic buildings and classrooms. We have a plan to prioritize the most significant academic investments, like McGraw, like Brad make sure those get done. Programmatic investment, we're planning on investments that need to be done to house BME, biomedical engineering, that was a commitment that was made when we named the school. Computer and information sciences is exploding. They have the highest student to faculty ratio of any program on campus. We really need to expand already. Their space out of date, and we have a plans to do that. New student housing, as I described, renovate existing residence halls, and then work on College Town with partners. And part of this will be a campaign associated on the academic enterprise, focusing on endowed faculty positions. You'll hear about this more in the spring as we roll this out and President Pollack comes on board. But we have a plan really to focus our communications and our philanthropy on our academic enterprise, focusing on faculty at the senior and junior level, but also on postdocs and on graduate students in a way in which we can have a menu, if you will, of investment opportunities for our philanthropic campaign. So I should add that I spent a lot of time with President Designate Mark Pollack, who sees this as very similar to some of the decisions that Michigan has made and is very enthusiastic about this, and will continue to have those discussions as she gears up to come here in April. So next steps are ongoing discussions with the Board of Trustees regarding whether we do this with debt, whether we do this in public private partnership, how we ensure that we get high quality construction at the best price, discussions with President Designate Pollack. Board of Trustees, we're asking them in January to approve the overall concept, and then specific capital plan in the spring Board of Trustees meeting with initiate a capital plan very quickly this coming summer if possible so that we could get some buildings open by 2020. That would allow us to accept the larger class in 2020. There will be no new students until then. I think I can skip this for the relevant really to the faculty and take any questions that you have.
Question.
Jesse's got a question.
Hi, Jesse.
Hi. Wondering that you said you'd come back. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about financial aid and taking on 250 more new students and those students will bring in more tuition, but that also will mean there might be more students who require financial aid. So how is financial aid going to be maintained and how will financial aid be able to be provided to this more students that we can support?
Yeah. So it's a great question. So what we've done is done a full financial plan beginning in 2020, the intake of students, taking into account the same level of financial aid need that we currently have, and then modeling those costs, the cost of new faculty, the cost of new staff, and then predicting the revenue associated with that. So all of that is taken into account with this plan. It's how we sort of size this, partially how we size it. We also size it based on academic demand. But there will be no decrease in commitment to financial aid, and there will be no decrease so there will be no change in policy for financial aid associated with this plan. I do want to make one other point, though, in full disclosure, and that's something that I'd be glad to come back and talk about. I have talked with the financial aid and admissions committee, some of the members may be in this room, that about looking at our financial aid policy with something else in mind, not reducing any expenditures on financial aid, keeping the same amount of expenditures on financial aid, but looking if there's opportunities to adjust the policy around making that a little bit arguably fairer. And by that I mean the following. If you look at the cohorts of our financial aid, that Cornell divides our students into five cohorts based on family income and family ability to pay. The lowest income of that, over the last 20 years, the co- cost of a Cornell education has come down to about half of what it was 20 years ago in real terms. So it hasn't gone up. It's half of what it was. The second cohort is about two-thirds of what it was. The third cohort, about 75%. And the fourth cohort, the highest aided cohort, is about the same as what it was 20 years ago. The problem is the unaided cohort of undergraduate students increases like this over inflation. It's increasing at an unsustainable rate. This year is the second year that we've had in the last 30 that we've had increases in tuition less than 4% at Cornell. So that what I'd like to see is us flatten that curve, because the individuals at the bottom of that curve, the family incomes at the bottom of the unaided group or the slightly aided group at the fourth, are the ones that are seeing this increase that is untempered. So what I've asked, this is a committee, it's got students on it, faculty on it, administrators on it, is let's look and think about proposals that would not take any money out of financial aid, but think about this problem and allow us to increase our tuition less by spreading this out a little bit more. And so that's basically what I've asked them to do. They'll come back with a proposal. We'll talk about any proposal. Be glad to come back to GPSA and talk about that, as well as SA, EA, and UA.
Lucia.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just wondering to what extent you might see parallels between like the projected coverage for the increased expenditures and the projected coverage for increased expenditures that might arise in like the services Gannett provides, because those projections made on tuition seem really stable, but it's not necessarily as stable to project how many of the new students would be paying like the health fee, for example.
Yeah, it's a great point. We have modeled out the same level of expenditure. You know, we think about the total cost of attending, housing, tuition, and student health. There is a component of this that is quite complicated and tied to financial aid. So, for example, if we raise housing prices right now, we don't generate any more income. We simply switch income from the academic units to student and campus life, because we have to fund the full cost of increase on students on financial aid that are maxed. And we increase the cost of attendance, so we increase their allotment. And some of those go off campus. Of course, a significant fraction go off campus. So it's quite a mix. The one thing I would say is that we're not projecting a dramatic increase in healthcare costs as part of this. We're considering this extends on a trajectory that it currently is. Now, I should say that one of the things that one worries about in these projections is if we have another downturn. So when we had the last downturn, our financial aid expenditure went up significantly. The fraction of students on financial aid and the need of those students went up substantially. So I also asked the committee to think about what our policies would be in anticipation of that were it to occur. There is enough, I'm convinced, having looked at this carefully, enough resources in this model with this increase in enrollment to be able to handle lots of, it provides some degrees of freedom to handle this. The problem previously was that we made this increase in investment in financial aid. It was a courageous increase in financial aid investment. The problem is we had no way to pay for it other than the trustees allowed us to take $35 million additional draw from the endowment for 5 years, but then cut it off. In the meantime, all the pressure was on the academic budgets to squeeze. And that's what we've seen for the last 6 or 8 years.
Hey,
Sorry. I did.
I have three questions, but let's start with this fair. So I'll start with the first two and then go to the third one. So the first question I had was the part that I guess one additional enrollment question is the idea of like master's students, professional master's students.
Why not master's?
I'm sorry.
You mean why not master's rather than?
Oh no, I'm asking whether my understanding was that provost, based on what you just told us, that provost has some say in the enrollment numbers that colleges take on for particular undergrad. I was wondering what the mechanism was for professional.
Great point. There essentially is no. The provost does not control the enrollment in master's programs. Those are college-based decisions. They don't impact our on-campus housing, by and large. The provost does control, we approve any new master's programs. But, for example, if the engineering college wants to increase its MN program or decrease it, as they did last year, that is really up to them. The revenue goes to them. It's not part of this pooled undergraduate revenue. And it's a way in which colleges are essentially incentivized to create programs that make sense academically and provide revenue to invest in academics.
So I guess that leads into the second question is that considering that there seems to be a lot of financial pressure on these departments, and they are incentivized to drop possibly as little as possible, and I know that there is often a lot of care to make sure that the program is as best as it can, but then there's clearly such a strong incentive to sort of like master. So I'm just trying to understand, when you have so many additional students, either through master's programs and through undergraduate programs, has the university carefully thought and analyzed the effect of systematic increase of students on student services?
Right. So we have looked at student services. I would say I don't think there's going to be a dramatic increase in master's students, so I would just question the predicate because, for example, the engineering school last year decreased their MN students. Why did they do that? Certainly not because they didn't want the revenue. They did it because the demand was not there at the quality that they wanted. And so there is one of the reasons to do undergraduate and not master's here is that we have so many qualified undergraduate applicants to Cornell that we could take another entire class of freshmen without really compromising quality in a major. That may be somewhat of an mistake. But the master's program is much more sensitive to demand, and that's really a sort of self-limiting factor. The other thing that colleges are doing now also is looking at those degree programs, some of which are online programs, where they have master's programs that are either mixed or blended programs with a lot of the activity off campus and some restricted on campus. So you're seeing a lot more of those, which of course have a much less impact on our on the staff and student service.
So I think you talked about increasing class sizes and like change of ratio, and then you talked about strategies to ratio and how that's historically important, right? I was wondering whether that same sort of analysis was done for number of TAs to students, and are we expecting increases in workloads or would probably return to
that? No, so actually the analysis included more residents. So we price that into the process. So again, it's a model. We sort of take our best guess of what we'll need, understanding that for faculty or graduate students, you take BME, for example, biomedical engineering. Well, they already have the faculty. They already have the graduate students. They don't have the students. So there, we don't think there's going to be as much hiring as would be needed perhaps in other areas. So we took our best guess in trying to look at this and model this in a reasonable way, and we think we've taken all the factors into account.
We have time for one question or three questions.
Nature's last question was
okay. Good. Then Majer, you have one question. Okay.
I have three, but I'll do. But just to say, it was well. so I think that, let me repeat your question, see if I have it right. You're concerned that we're adding more students, we'll house them as freshmen and sophomores, but then as juniors and seniors, there are more students creating demand in college now. That's your point? Yeah. And absolutely, that's true. And that's actually one of the discussion points we're having around building more undergraduate beds in college town. And the way in which we don't do it, but we're advising and discussing and collaborating with how those would be constructed, whether they have RAs in the living there, et cetera, what's the type of environment that we want for our students there. And that conversation is going on not just with undergraduate housing in college town, but more faculty housing in college town. You've seen the great expansion of graduate student or professional student housing in college town on 79. But there's a larger conversation about multiple types of housing, retail opportunities in college town as well, that we hope provide the capacity for this demand, plus also provide between our taking some students out of college town in as sophomores that would normally be there, that's 1,400 right now, roughly 1,450, taking it out of the demand, plus the new housing that creates hopefully a situation in which we provide more high-quality housing and the demand issue becomes different. Right now, you know, everything is occupied. You have 100% occupancy in college town, whether it's crappy or nice, and the price doesn't really reflect, seems to us, whether it's crappy or nice. But then, the sun is here, please don't put so we think we can structure the demand a little bit to have a positive impact, not a negative impact. But we're thinking about that.
All right, that is all we have time for. Thank you very much.
Great.
So, if people have questions, how can they reach out?
MIK7@cornell.edu.
Say that again?
MIK7 or provost@cornell.edu.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cool. All right. Now we have Ulysses Smith. You're the chair of the EA.
I am.
Chair of the EA and what's your long title? I had to extend the box. Lead Diversity and Inclusion Strategist and the Department of Inclusion and Workforce Diversity.
Yeah. Oh, this is going to be stretched, so we'll make it work as best we can.
Thank you.
That's so great. Mic check in the back. Are you good on hearing me? Yes? Okay, great. So this is one of those rare occasions when my day job has ended up leading into the night, which becomes a night job, which I'm not too thrilled about, but I'm always happy to be here with you all. So I'm not speaking to you today as the EA chair, but I'm so glad the provost mentioned us so we know we're not forgotten. staff are here too. But I'm here speaking to you in the capacity as part of, you know, the dreaded administration. But I promise I'm one of the fun parts of the administration, despite the subject matter. So as Nate mentioned, my title is very long. It's Lead Diversity and Inclusion Strategist and Title IX Coordinator for Analytics and Reporting in the Department of Inclusion and Workforce Diversity. And that was a presentation we can all go home. No, but I come here on kind of the request of a lot of your advisors in the graduate school, as well as some other folks, to really speak to you today in a capacity that occupies about 10% of my job capacity, which is the overseeing the reporting bias system, and what the system is actually for, how it's used in terms of the data that's been collected, and how we use that to support the universities, or determine in many cases the university's strategic initiatives as they pertain specifically to diversity and inclusion on campus. So I'm really just going to spend a quick minute kind of talking about some of the changes that have happened to the system over the last year. You all got the annual report. It's still in draft form. I expect it to be up very shortly. It has gone through quite a few revisions, and we're just waiting on the final tweaking of language from council's office. We should be good to go. But the data itself is set. That's not going to change. Before the language around it. And I'll talk about some of those things, what has happened since then, and how we can go forward, and why it's very important that you all, as graduate professional students, utilize this system. You all have been identified as one important that we get those reports, and I'll tell you why. So essentially, over the last couple of years, what has happened, if you recall, in the land before, I'll say in the era of EU, so that's before you listen, there were about five or so different offices responsible for collecting all this information, and there were five or so different reporting forms that you could go to report different types of conduct. Nobody really knew who was responsible for it. You'd probably get five different answers from those offices when it came to resolving those matters. And then came, you know, the big wake-up call for many of us when I first was handed this job and was told, here's the reporting bias system, go fix it. By the way, three assemblies are putting forth resolutions against this system to try to figure it out. At the same time, we were hit with our first OCR complaint that was filed, and part of that request was from the federal government was, give us all your cases from the past five academic years, and the university's overall response to each of those cases. Well, as you might imagine, in decentralized Cornell University, dealing with those five or so different offices, it was very, very, very hard to figure out what the university's response was. You had the crisis managers doing something, workforce policy and labor relations doing something, today's office doing something, workforce diversity doing something, and maybe a couple other folks in the university. It was very challenging. So in an unprecedented move, we centralized something. Okay? We centralized it. So you now have one reporting form, and that's one of the first things that's detailed in that report. You have one reporting form. Bias concerns at cornell.edu takes you directly to that reporting form where you can report a multitude of conduct, which we'll talk about. We've used that system now to collect all the data that you see in front of you. We know now what the climate is in very specific pockets of the institution. So it doesn't go that far down in that data that you have in front of you, but we can do that on our end and say, wow, we have, you know, 10 or so instances in the last month around race and ethnicity or race color within Cornell 9. We know that. We can pinpoint that. We can say it involves temporary staff or it involves students, and we can figure out what we need to do with that. This data is really used to drive our strategic initiatives. So when you think of the university's overall framework toward your destination, anybody heard that? No? Yes? No? Sort of, ooh, gotta do better. Well, good job security for me. gotta do better. When you think about how we encourage colleges and units to choose their initiatives under that framework, we bring in this data and say, well, you know, division of X, you have this problem, you have this area where I really think you need to spend some time focusing on it. Think of an initiative around composition that might be better. Think of an initiative around inclusion that really might address this pocket of issues that you're having in this area. And we can do that very strategically, and we can now measure a lot of things. We can now support a lot of the initiatives we are asking to take on because we have this information. So the system overall, what is it? If you haven't seen the system before, you did it. It's now, as I said, a central system where you can report all types of content. And so that includes all the big things that come under Policy 6.4, which I'm sure many of you have either worked on or heard about. That's given me a lot of job security in the last year. You know, so that's pretty great. So anything that falls under the big umbrella of bias. So everybody is very, very hard pressed to define what bias is, but the university does have a definition of it. It encompasses kind of acts of bigotry, intimidation, and harassment, or other acts that are based on any that long list of protected status category and or other related factors. So it is kind of a big umbrella catch-all term for a lot of the activity that happens that might not reach the threshold for discrimination and harassment or something else that would trigger a different process under 6.4. Again, you can report discrimination and harassment, the quad that falls under sexual misconduct, as well as dating violence, stalking, domestic violence, so all of those items are categorized as well. Those of you, if you have access to the reporting form right now, I strongly encourage you to pull it up and look at it. You can do it on your phone too. It's mobile accessible. You're welcome. This millennial is joining the administration. Boy, things have changed. So that is something that you're able to do, as well as other concerns. So one of the big things I tell people is if it makes you uncomfortable, you should probably report it. Okay? That doesn't trigger an automatic investigation or anything like that. And we'll talk about what happens after you report something. But I'd much rather have over-reporting than under-reporting of incidents that happen. It's not up to you all to determine whether something is bias or discrimination or harassment or something else. That's what we get paid to do. That's our job. So you just report it. Don't worry about what it is. You just report it. Let us know student had an issue with a staff member or two staff members had an issue or a faculty staff had an issue, and they might have walked to one of their local discrimination and harassment advisors or to their local HR person or have gone to workforce policy and labor relations. Those items were never being reported back centrally. They didn't work. Different people kept their own reports. So really what was happening was we had no clue what the pulse was in the workplace. So we have no idea what the climate is or what some of the issues that are taking place are in the workplace. So that even pertains to some of you all, since it's a weird place where graduate students often become employees in certain senses. So a lot of the things that are happening, we just had no clue about. Is that exciting for you all? You're kind of, sometimes you're a little like, But some of the other things that come up, you can still report. So still, there's still an ethics hotline, but you can still report those ethics concerns there. So, you know, inappropriate relationships or cheating or things like that. Cheating separate from inappropriate relationships. Hazing, criminal activity, and community disruption. Big deal. So those of you who have suffered through a training of mine on bias in this system, you will know that I harp on this point a lot. This is a non-emergency reporting form. In the back, this is a non-emergency reporting form. What did I just say? Choir. Take it to the top.
Non-emergency reporting
form. Do not use this form to report emergencies. That is not what this form is for. If you are experiencing an emergency or you see something happening, who should you call? Who should you call? Do not call the police. Call 911. Do not call me. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Don't call me. Do not take the time to fill out this form in that circumstance. Trust me. 911 or 255-1111. You will get the appropriate first responder. The police and all other first responders are very, very good, I have to say, very good about filling out a report and sending it along to us when that report needs to be filled out. So you don't need to worry about that. In the event of emergency, you need to deal with the emergency. Okay? Whew. At the same time, this report, you can use this form 24/7. So it's accessible, again, as I said, on mobile devices and all types of other things. This system was originally put in place to really address matters when the perpetrator was unknown. But it has since grown to be where you can know anybody, you don't have to know the person, you can get as much information as you need in order to respond to the matter, so you can use it that way. And it's a great tool for bystander intervention when it comes to that. So if you're unsure about how to respond to something in the midst of it happening, you can at least fill out the form, let us know that it's happening, we're able to target it that way. So think about those instances where you have kind of a major event, you're at the Avicii concert, somebody comes up, some random person says it, does something horrible to you. You've probably never seen that person, you're probably never going to see them again, but you want the university to know that something happened so then we can figure out and direct our resources where they need to go in order for us to better address it. I do want to make a very quick note before I move on about this about privacy versus confidentiality. All employees, with the exception of very few, they have a duty to consult. Even you all, when you're acting as an employee, when you're acting as a TA or as an advisor, you have a duty to consult. Somebody discloses sexual misconduct to you that includes data about information about the company, you must consult with a university official or have my employer to handle. And that can be fulfilled by filling out the online reporting form. If you or anybody else wishes to speak to somebody confidentially, take advantage of the confidential resources that are available. They do not share information with us except in a very rare circumstance when there is an immediate threat to safety or to the university's mission overall. Other than that, they do not share those conversations. What happens when somebody files a report? Everybody asked for a flowchart, but then they gave us the flowchart and it was unreasonable. So here you go, because I'm a simplistic person. You fill out the report, it gets triaged by a person, a human being. I read every single report that comes in. It is a lot, but I read it all. I decide whether there needs an immediate response from me or if it can go to one of our appropriate teams. That team is responsible for issuing the appropriate response. That's in a nutshell. If you're interested in seeing who sits on our bias assessment and review team for all the incidents of bias, discrimination, and harassment, you go to hr.cornell.edu. There's a whole section dedicated to bias reporting, you can see that. And that team encompasses all types of folks from the JA's office, my office, the graduate school we partner with, all types of, again, the police, everybody. So just so you understand, if you're interested in seeing what's actually reported, go on diversity.cornell.edu/addressing bias activity or follow those directions to get it along. vague enough so that we wouldn't use the whole people's information, and that they would be easily, you would be able to easily tell what they are. But they are there, and we also list the outcomes. And so what we've done is what happens that in a method to encourage. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because you have in front of you with explanations, but the basics of it is since the introduction of the system in a central form, we've seen just about double the number of incidents that have been reported. When we talk about the nature of concern, by and large, race, color still become our highest category of protected status incidents. Although I should say we've started to see more incidents in the top category 13 of other no status indicators. These are things that are not based on protected status, but people are seeing other things, maybe bullying that's happening that people are now reporting. Location, most things are happening on campus. But I do want to point out that category, which is the first long number that you see there, 39 incidents. Social media. Oh my goodness. Please be mindful of what you put on social media. Now, we are not in the business of policing anybody's private social media accounts. I have better things to do. But when it does cross over to that line of possibly creating a hostile environment, people do report you. When you put your affiliation with the university on there, people report that activity. Sexual misconduct, I want to make very clear in the report, and it's spelled out very clearly, those are reports, not formal complaints. A report is when somebody makes somebody, you, a student, or somebody else tells a responsible employee that something has happened, then the university is put on notice. That does not necessarily yield a formal complaint, okay? And then, so you'll see that that's our number, we've 134 reported incidents. Again, sexual assault is a very, very broad category. You can include public lewdness, rape, battery, sexual abuse. So I don't want you to read that number and think we had 74 rapes. That is not the case. It is anything that falls under that definition under 6.4. And that should be it. Location, again, mostly happening off campus. Where we are right now, because everybody seems so curious, as of October 31st, this is where our numbers stand in comparison to the last fiscal year at the same time. So you see we've increased significantly. And that is, I think, by and large, because of the education that's been going on around the system, but also because we've gotten now reports from the workplace. So with that, I'm going to take two questions.
Rick. So I know this is another status indicator. So is this specifically for protected status harassment by incidents, things like that, or like is this for any of harassment or behavior that a student might experience?
Any instance. This system is not limited. This is not a system where we say only you who has an instance of protected status harassment or anything you use the system. This is for any alleged misconduct, any form of prohibited conduct on campus, you use this form to report it. And you can do so anonymously or not. There's a section on the form, I encourage you all to look at the form. There's a section on the bottom that says that asks you how you want to be involved going forward. So you can say reporting anonymously, I want to be anonymous to everybody else involved, but I'm okay with you knowing who I am, so you can give me resources. Or you're reporting on behalf of somebody else and you don't want to contact me. So there are different ways to do it, either so you're anonymous or not, so that at least maintain privacy, but it is for anybody, in any form.
Nisha.
Thank you. Could you possibly elaborate a little bit on what your response is when there's a workplace complaint specifically against one faculty? Because one reason graduate students may not feel comfortable reporting is if you are one of two graduate students in someone's lab, him or her is going to know it was one of you, and there is a fear of like retaliation for that.
Right.
So how do you handle that process when it's brought to you?
So it depends on the form of conduct. So if it's something that falls under kind of the realm of bias, discrimination, or harassment, or maybe kind of a workplace climate concern, and so our first step is always to send a note to the reporter or the complainant, depending on who it is. The reporter or the complainant, just a pair of concerns, say, here's who we are, here's what we can offer. You can choose the responses or not, but if you want to meet and talk about it, you can do that. We walk them through what their options might be under 6.4 or the code or other things. I would say a lot of the time, a lot of the requests we get are basic, what we want to be able to have a conversation with the person, with the faculty member. So we will do that. Or will help give the person tools to have it. In other circumstances, it might be that we get really creative and we say, well, that is so funny. We have this great pilot program that we're thinking of doing, and your department seems so appropriate to do that so that we're not targeting the faculty members specifically, but we make sure that the department chair knows this is something your entire department needs to do. Here's what it is. And you might work with a local HR person or other people, as long as the complainant or the reporter is comfortable with that, to make sure that that happens. So we get really creative, but we do our first part. support it, and that they are advised of their options first. So we don't proceed without the complainant's report. See if there's enough information. If you do it anonymously and you don't even give us the department for where it happens, it's very hard for us to respond. So if you do choose to report anonymously, I would strongly encourage you to give us at least the name of either the accused or where the, what department's behavior is occurring, and we can address that.
Thank you very much. And how do people contact you if they have more questions about the system or anything?
Sure. If you want to contact me, please reach out. Walk into 150 Day Hall. I'm pretty much there most of the time. I work from home on Tuesday, so don't look for me tomorrow. But you can answer your phone number. I'm available.
All right. Good.
Also,
another
thing to
make people
think
about.
Yeah.
We're already off the calendar. Shit.
Hey, I don't want that. It
was nice to the 2 hours.
Someone who has been on the SC before to run as SC chair?
Or no.
literally no one heard the Kermit and wanted to know. Okay, so I'm going to say to you this. Can you talk for like 30 seconds to you on SVU and how it operates, and then we'll put a pin in this.
From January 1st?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So. Now, so here's another option we could do, is we could also elect an interim chair while we try and hold this over. If someone is interested in joining the SBA and potentially maybe picking up, I think it could be done after going through a couple of SBA meetings. But I would, as a former member myself, I would strongly encourage someone to get some experience on it before we move to a chair position, because it's a very critical committee, and it's actually quite.
Not only is it critical, next year is a student activity cycle setting year.
Oh, that's an appropriation thing.
But between both of them, they both
have
so, yeah.
Yeah, actually, so one of the reasons I want to So one of the this is way past 30 seconds, but the idea is that the finance, the FE chair oversees the allocation of budgets based on all the applications that the FE receives. And often they're sort of responsible for putting the meeting together and making sure that requirements are communicated to the individual groups so that this maximizes the need to get funds. And I would also, echoing what Nate said, really discourage people who haven't already done this to take up a chair position, but I think it would be a good time to be a part of the FC because you'll be sort of overseeing broad changes in how they allocate money for next year, because we just passed all that group all the way through. Considering that I was a part of the training process, I understand those rules pretty well because I don't have to write them.
For the FC chair, full command, or for the for.
Let's do intern, and if we can't find anyone.
All right. Well. So I'll take a motion. So this is how I'm going to interpret this. You can tell me if it's not true. Motion to elect. Or to nominate yourself as an interim chair position.
Point of parliamentary procedure.
I can say, so tell me what I'm doing.
You don't move to nominate yourself, and it doesn't require a second. What we'd be doing is moving to strike from the elections the election for FC chair and move instead to vote for an interim FC chair.
Yes. Okay, hearing no dissent, we're now electing an interim chair. Tasia has nominated himself for that position. And if you are interested in running for the full chair, please also see Anisha about getting on the SC as it stands, because we could elect that at a later date this next semester. Did you have something else you wanted to say, Anisha, by the way?
I was wondering whether I had to second nomination or not.
No.
Point of inquiry, how many people are on the FC right now?
On the dashboard, it says 7.
Okay.
How many people actually have meetings?
On a full vote, should be 11. 10.
Any other nominations for interim FC chair? All right, seeing none, I'm going to we can elect Kasia by unanimous consent. Is there anyone opposed to electing Kasia to the interim FC chair? Seeing none, Kasia is now elected to the interim FC chair. All right, so now we move on to the appropriations committee chair. Similar to the FCA, the reason why we use these ones this time of year is because the positions are very complicated and they require a certain amount of overlap with the previous predecessors. Are there any nominations for the appropriations committee chair?
I'd like to nominate Tyler McCann.
Tyler McCann, are you here? Do you accept the nomination?
I do.
All right. Are there any other nominations for appropriations chair? All right, seeing none. Tyler, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself first, and then we'll...
So, hey, everyone. My name is Tyler McCann. I'm the Pages Guild rep.
How are you going to do that being?
I will speak to Sarah in terms of I will be contacting Asia and Tyler to get you dashboard access so you can own that. Or not own it, but have access to your committees.
Yes. And we're going to work on, there's still some people who haven't gotten their committee assignments or haven't heard that. We're working on getting that out to you because that's way too long. Appropriations.
Our next meeting will be December 6th at 6 p.m. And we have a couple of new members that are going to be at this meeting, so I'm going to be talking.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.